This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Hoppy, fruity, malty, nutty. However you like your beer, there's a New Hampshire brew just for you. Joining us to discuss the local craft beer scene is Brian Aldrich and Michael Meredith, co-hosts of the Seacoast Beverage Lab podcast, also authors of a new book, New Hampshire Beer, Brewing from Sea to Summit. In the introduction, Brian writes that the number of craft breweries in New Hampshire has doubled since he started writing about beer way back in 2010, an explosion that shows no signs of letting up. Brian, Michael, welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Glad you're here. So like wine enthusiasts, craft beer lovers have a lot of funny ways of describing brews. Some that I looked at online included scalded milk, newly mowed lawn, horse blankety. So what is the weirdest description of a beer that you two have ever heard?
I think I'm getting used to the words earthy and farmhousey. So a lot of saisons or farmhouse beers kind of have that grassy, as you were saying, taste. But kind of those wine tasting terms that are now making their way into the beer world.
Yeah. Anything for you?
Yeah, similar in that sense where, you know, like from the earth, you know, very nature-like.
You know, horse blankety, you have not
never heard.
I actually just heard horse blankety for the first time this past weekend, and it took me by surprise because I'd never, ever want to consume anything that is described in that fashion.
So that is the kind of language that beer lovers might use amongst themselves, certainly.
Right. Mm-hmm.
This book is less of a critical text where you'd find those kind of descriptions and more of a beer encyclopedia. So tell me a little bit about that decision to identify and to locate, but not rate or judge beers and breweries that you cover. Brian?
Yeah, so we're experiencing a crazy uptick in breweries, as I wrote in the introduction. And even now in the book, you're going to find 25 breweries, but now there are 35 registered breweries in New Hampshire. So there's 10 more. But what we wanted to do was highlight the breweries that have been around for 20 years. So as these new breweries are opening up, people won't forget about the old guys that are still around, like the Portsmouth breweries, the Millie's Taverns, the Martha's Exchanges, and the, you know, Tuckerman's, the older breweries, because they have kind of laid this ground for these new breweries by changing some laws or just getting beer accepted by the state.
Well, we'll get to the upstarts later, but talk a little bit about the history. The book starts with an important piece of New Hampshire history, which is the Frank Jones Brewery.
Right.
Now, this is back in the mid-19th century on the seacoast in Portsmouth.
Exactly.
What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, Frank Jones was kind of a, you know, they say man, the myth, the legend, because he was a business owner first, mayor second, and a brewer third. So he's one of a kind in that he ran the town of Portsmouth by owning, you know, 10 to 15 separate businesses in the town, all while being a mayor and a brewer. So he's very unique. And it was one of the biggest breweries on the East Coast, and at a time brewed more beer than any other brewery in the country. So he was quite a pioneer in that. And then when that went out of the way, Anheuser-Busch showed up in 1975, which is now one of the biggest breweries in New England.
And a lot of people have been curious as to why we included them in this book. And we wanted to take this time to specify that the name of this book is not New Hampshire Craft Beer. It's New Hampshire Beer. Mm-hmm. We wanted to include all facets of the brewing community. We didn't want to leave them out just because they're considered a macro. And we know there's been a lot of I guess you can say disdain towards the macros, you know, in this craft beer boom. But we have to remember, though, that these are New Hampshire citizens that go to work every single day, you know, at this facility, and they brew just like, you know, a small microbrewery would brew. And these guys take a lot of pride, women and men take a lot of pride in the product that they put out. I mean, this facility, as Brian and I were just discussing this morning, you know, produces all the beer for the New England region, which is a humongous population that they need to consistently serve on a, you know, yearly basis. And we wanted to make sure that they were included in this journey.
So. Okay. So you covering the macro and the micro.
Of course.
And some of the big names here that you mentioned, Brian, Tuckerman's, that's
yep.
one, Smutty Nose, Red Hook. Tell us about some of the upstarts that are now hitting the craft scene.
So the first one that comes to mind, and from the earlier upstart boom, was Throwback. Throwback mm-hmm. kind of there's an ebb and flow that's been happening with the craft beer scene. You know, in 1990s there were a couple Then there was silence in 2000. Then in 2009, Moat Mountain started, and now Throwback came in the game in 2011, and they kind of paved the way for a lot of nano breweries. Now, New Hampshire is one of the only states that has a nano brewery license, which is for a very small cost. I believe it's just above $200. You can have a license to brew a nano brewery, which is a very small 1 to 3 barrel system of beer. And these ladies, Nicole and Annette, started this boom in the Seacoast area of New Hampshire by having a very local focus. 80% of a beer is brewed with all local ingredients.
So legislatively, you know, we have some openings for small brewers. How about teaching people? I understand that there is a brewery in Hooksett that actually has an apprentice program that is helping to sort of shape the next generation of brewers.
Yeah, that's White Birch. And a lot of breweries will offer, you know, internships if you come and ask them. Some do not, but Bill Herlicka over at White Birch started with the idea that I want to build my dream of a brewery, but I also want people to, if they have an idea or a dream to start a brewery, take the ride with me and learn how to brew. So he'll put these guys to work, and or women in this case. There's one woman in the book who the very first apprentice who helped out and doing anything from cleaning the kegs to cleaning the fermenters. But at the end of all of that, they get to brew their own beer and then release it at their big like commencement graduation party.
And to Brian's point too, this kind of circles back to the overall theme that we wanted to place when we were showcasing each one of these breweries, is that it truly is a communal effort. You know, a lot of these breweries require the support from the community, the local citizens, and the local population to, you know, not only keep their dream alive, but keep it sustainable. And, you know, bringing people in from the community that are interested in the brewing process, interested in the craft beer scene, is just going to help it grow more, you know, into the future. So it really, truly is a neat experience to see people this interested in not only bringing people in to their small circle, but, you know, grooming them, you know, so that they can join the craft brewing community. It's a very interesting approach. So.
That's Michael Meredith. I'm speaking with him and with his co-beer aficionado, Brian Aldrich. They're hosts of the Seacoast Beverage Lab podcast and authors of the new book called New Hampshire Beer, Brewing from Sea to Summit. What would you say distinguishes New Hampshire beers from varieties elsewhere?
It's tough because the craft beer scene right now, it everywhere is all about passion. So while it's not distinguishable amongst any other state, the theme of craft beer is passion and camaraderie. I believe what distinguishes, and this might kind of bring it down a tick, we were talking with David Yarrington of Smutty Nose when we were writing the book, and he had mentioned that out of all craft beer sales just in New Hampshire, New Hampshire-made craft beer is less than 2% of total sales.
Is that a problem of exposure? Do people know it's there?
Yeah,
is it quality?
Absolutely.
Distribution?
It's definitely a problem of exposure, which is why our book has come out a great time. But that's not for that purpose. It's obviously to shed light on all these breweries. But there's a lot of laws in New Hampshire which bring in other breweries' beer from, you know, other states like, you know, Stone, Lagunitas. A lot of bigger breweries come into the state which are, you know, New Hampshire residents would like to try and drink, but we don't have that exposure from a marketing standpoint for the Board of Travel and Tourism to promote these breweries. Now we have it's in the book, Brew NH is a marketing group that is going to try to put these beer trail maps in all these tourism spots around the state. So when you go into a hotel, you go into a store, you're going to pick up a map that shows all 30 breweries that are open, and you can go to these breweries. You know, you go to Henniker, New Hampshire, you now know there's a Henniker Brewing Company there, or you're up in North Conway and you know there's Tuckerman's Brewery or Moat Mountain. So now you're going to know that there's breweries wherever you are you might not have known before.
Looking at the whole landscape is important too from a national perspective. The big two, AB InBev and Miller Coors, truly do still dominate the beer scene. I mean, the craft beer consumption and sales is hovering around 10-11%, you know, in the whole market. I believe it actually may be lower than that at this point, but it's growing steadily. We're starting to see that shift. You know, people are starting to, you know, introduce themselves into things that they may not consume on a daily basis, and they're going out of their comfort zone, and they're pleasantly surprised. It's an industry where if you like a certain taste, guaranteed you can find that type of beer, you know, that, or that type of flavor that you're looking to capture. And it's really an exciting time. So,
to hear someone speaking to that surprise, this is Norman Miller. He's from the Metro West Daily News. You recently had him on the podcast.
Yep.
He goes by Real Beer Nut
Twitter.
Yep. Let's hear what he had to say about some of the Northeast breweries that have opened in the past few years.
These breweries aren't adding anything. Some are just plain out bad. You go to the store, and if you're a new craft beer drinker, And you grab random beers off the shelf and they all taste exactly the same. Why would you keep buying them when they cost twice as much as the regular crap beer you've been drinking all your whole life?
Okay. Thoughts on that,
well,
guys?
So, and for, in full disclosure, Norm is on the show every week that we do. It's me, Mike, and then two other, Sean, Jansen, and Carla, companion. So every week we banter back and forth. Norm has a great point, which kind of leads into a discussion about will there be a craft beer bubble? And the answer is we don't see it yet. But when we were talking with Peter Eggleston of Portsmouth Brewery and Smutty Nose, he had mentioned a time in the early 90s where all of these vanity labels showed up. So you go to this store that has craft beer, but you're not really sure about the brewery because you see these pretty labels and not so much description of who brewed the beer, but you buy it anyway. Peter has said that he does see that happening again, where these breweries might start up, make bad beer, but make a pretty label just so you buy the beer. That might happen again. It certainly isn't happening in New Hampshire yet from what we've seen. The 35 breweries that are licensed right now are producing great beer. So we'll just have to wait and see for that.
How about economic viability? I mean, I know that there are a couple. You mentioned the Moat in North Conway earlier, or the Brew Pub in Keene, I'm thinking of. They're restaurant-based. Their beer is brewed locally, served locally. One, is it sustainable by itself without a restaurant? Two, when do you see those local craft beers distributing beyond their sort of location and getting into store shelves all over the state?
Honestly, I feel that that is the decision of the brewery itself. A lot of these breweries make the conscious decision to stay small to protect their brand and to protect the type of quality of beer that they're producing. And there is the problem of growing too fast too quickly, or growing too big too quickly, rather. And that's truly falls on the shoulders of the breweries themselves. I mean, nobody's forcing them to grow fast. It's just 9 times out of 10, people hit the ground running right out of the gate, and they find themselves, you know, at, like, not being able to make enough beer to meet demand. Well, that doesn't necessarily mean you have infinite demand. That doesn't necessarily mean that every single person in, you know, the Granite State is looking to consume your beer every day in mass quantities, so you need to expand.
Right, and so if you take a look back at, you mentioned Keene, so Elm City has been there, I believe, either this year or next year. They're celebrating their 20th year. So Deb, who runs that brewery, and Ben Mullett, who's the brewer, have been brewing these great beers for, you know, 15, 20 years, and the town loves them. I think with this book and the help of BrewNH, will hopefully bring people too keen to get a growler of beer to bring home. What another brewery is doing in Manchester, Millie's Tavern, they just started distributing their beer. So soon, for those that are listening and that read the book, Stark Brewing Company is basically Millie's Tavern, but in a bottle. So you can go to anywhere from North Conway to Portsmouth to Keene and pick up a bottle from Millie's Tavern just because they had extra space to brew that beer. So that's one way of a brewery that wants to kind of get some more reach.
It makes it more of an exciting destination point, too, when these breweries are smaller and they only maybe even distribute just within their region or just on premise at their location. Like Brian and I, one of our favorite, you know, honestly, one of our favorite trips during this whole brewery was up in the mountain region when we visited Schilling Brewing Co., Beer Co., rather, and we were able to have the pleasure of meeting the Cozens, who started this brewery back in, was it October at this point?
Yeah. They started back in May of 2013.
That's what it was,
I
yes.
say back in, but it's hasn't been that long.
And they are producing amazing quality beer, an amazing restaurant right on the river, and they blew us away. And that was when Brian and I took a step back and we realized that it's not about getting big fast. It's about making a quality product, drawing in, you know, the patrons that you want at your facility and consistently having them come back, you know, and enjoying new, fresh, delicious beers on a daily, in some cases, a weekly basis. And as on the back of the book, you know, you can see the head brewer, John, that's him sniffing hops right there on premise at Schilling. And he is a mad scientist. He makes amazing beers. And he's just a small part of the amazing beer culture that we're starting to see develop here, where people truly care more about quality than quantity. And I think that's what's going to drive the beer scene moving forward.
Well, Schilling is a visit that you mentioned. Can I put you both on the spot and ask you if you've got a favorite New Hampshire craft brew?
Sure, Mike, go first.
Well, you know, we've been consistently saying that Schilling was our favorite spot, but you know, personally, in terms of a beer that I consistently go to on a you know on a weekly basis, I'm a big fan of Smutty Nose Finest Kind IPA. You know, I think they're brewing a consistent IPA that's just delicious, and I keep going back to it time and time again.
How about for you, Brian?
I live in on the seacoast. I used to live in Portsmouth, but I always find myself at least twice a week going to Earth Eagle Brewings. They've been open a couple years, I think two years almost on the to the date, and they have a beer called New England Gangsta, which is a West Coast IPA, and it's one of those beers that is becoming a cult following, where once that beer is put on tap, their small 40-person pub, 30-person pub is packed, and it's a great beer.
Brian Aldrich, beer master at the Sheraton Portsmouth Harborside Hotel, thanks so much.
Thanks.
And Michael Meredith, craft beer lover, and along with Brian, co-host of the Seacoast Beverage Lab podcast. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you for having us.
Together, they've written the book New Hampshire Beer, Brewing from Sea to Summit, and there's much more in the book at wordofmouthradio.com.
One, two, three. Beer, 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 Jiminy, beer, beer, beer.
A long time ago, way back in history, when all there was to drink was nothing but cups of tea, along came a man by the name of Charlie Mott, and he invented a wonderful drink and he made it out of hop.
Ever wonder what happens to all of that produce that grocery stores do not sell? Up next, we're going to hear about an effort in Pennsylvania to use unsold, decaying food to grow new food. That story when Word of Mouth continues after the break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. With fresh produce flooding into grocery stores this time of year, overabundance can become a problem. In fact, a report issued in 2012 by the National Resource Defense Council finds approximately 40% of the food grown and processed in the United States goes uneaten. Now, grocers in Pennsylvania are working to send truckloads of unsold produce to nearby farms for composting. And one unlikely store is spearheading the effort. Producer Hal B. Klein has the story.
It's a crisp autumn afternoon, and a blue five-axle truck rolls up the windy driveway of Dave Anderson's Echo Valley Farm in New Galilee, Pennsylvania, about an hour north of Pittsburgh. Anderson raises grass-fed beef, though he's fond of joking he's really a grass farmer. And he has a serious challenge. 40 of his 60 acres were stripped of all their nutrients.
Well, this land was strip mined and kind of pillaged back in the 50s. They took all the topsoil that was on top, and now it's on the bottom, and there's 30 foot of fill over top of it. It was like the surface of the moon. Nothing would grow here when I moved here. So I'm trying to bring the land back.
Anderson is part of a pilot program that's a partnership between some organizations you might not expect to work together. Walmart, a corporation often vilified for encouraging mass cheap consumption, and the Pennsylvania Resources Council, the oldest environmental nonprofit in the state. According to the PRC's Nick Shore, Walmart should be given credit for some of its environmental initiatives, too.
Walmart has several sustainable flags that they are entitled to wave. Walmart across the country has been diverting all of their food waste to, composting or anaerobic digesters or a range of good uses out of landfills.
In western Pennsylvania, for example, Dave Anderson is one of six farmers that are paid to take weekly shipments of at least 30 tons per farm of food waste. That's a mountain of molding food that'll add a lot of nutrients back to the soil.
The first time it came, I was expecting a truck about half the size.
The blue dumpster pulls forward. At first, a trickle of liquid and small bits of produce drip from the truck. And then...
This is unsold, semi-rotten produce from Walmart and Sam's Clubs in western and central PA. A lot of pumpkin squash, apples, peppers, lettuce, potatoes, pineapples, the full range. And very pure, very clean of impurities.
The USDA estimates that retail outlets such as Walmart lose around $15 billion annually in unsold produce. In urban areas, it's expensive to use the dump, so businesses have incentive to recycle food waste. But closer to the farm, it's cheaper to just throw it away.
And where it's most needed, it's not as economical.
Shore says that Walmart is paying a little extra for this eco-friendly disposal. He says that if the pilot program is successful, those disposal costs could come down, and that could encourage other rural and suburban businesses and even school districts to partner with farms too. Still, there are better ways to prevent food waste. For example, the Environmental Protection Agency says it would make sense to grow less food in the first place. But for now, Farmer Dave Anderson says, with so much food that needs to be disposed of, why not turn it into a natural fertilizer that'll help restore grassland like his?
You know, the other alternatives would be chemical resources, which work, but they're not long-term, they're expensive, and they also damage the ground. They help the plants, but they'll damage the ground as far as the microorganisms and worm population and stuff like that. With the compost, it's all upside.
And that, Anderson says, is the literal foundation for a healthy food system.
When you get the ground right, the grass is right. When the grass is right, the cows are right. And you can tell by your animals what kind of shape your ground and your grass is in, because they'll just walk past it if they don't like it.
For the Allegheny Front, I'm Hal B. Klein.
Once a Jeopardy whiz.
Bang, bang. His silver hammer came down upon her head. Watson.
What is Maxwell's silver hammer?
Yes.
IBM's Watson is now answering big questions in the kitchen. Up next, we're going to learn about Watson's culinary creations. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
Word,
word
of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth. Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We haven't heard much from IBM's Watson since its 2011 Jeopardy victory. But the cognitive computer has stayed busy with less publicized products like conducting healthcare research and financial planning. Now Watson is back in the spotlight for kitchen skills. This spring, IBM's cognitive cooking team programmed Watson to come up with new and original recipes. And Watson came through. Belgian bacon pudding, anyone? Producer Zach Nugent spoke with Watson's senior software engineer for cognitive cooking, Florian Pennell, to find out more about Watson's foray into food.
So first question, when did the idea come about to use the Watson technology for food?
We saw the success of Watson at Jeopardy, and we wanted to push the boundaries of cognitive computing and see if computers could also be creative and help users be creative. So we thought that food would be a great area to explore this.
Okay, I want you to kind of walk me through how this works. Say I'm a chef, and I want Watson to help me come up with some new menu items. What would happen first?
So first you're going to enter a few inputs. You're going to say, for example, that you want to make a dish with asparagus. Then Watson will tell you what cuisines, for example, use asparagus the most. Maybe it's Thai cuisine, and you could say, oh, Thai cuisine sounds interesting, or you can pick another cuisine. And then it will tell you what dishes you could try to make with asparagus, for example, a quiche. So you're going to enter those three parameters. And by the way, you can enter them pretty much in any order. You could enter more than one ingredient, more than one cuisine, exclude some ingredients, and so on. But we want to have those three pieces of information. Mm-hmm. And once you have them, we're going to try trillions or quadrillions of combinations, and we're going to provide recommendations.
How does Watson come up with the combinations? What programming has been done so Watson can come up with these things?
So we've parsed about 30,000 recipes that we found on wikia.com. We've also parsed Wikipedia pages about cuisines. We also have information about ingredients at the molecular level. We know what flavor compounds they contain. We know also their nutrition facts. So we use all that, and we start by looking at what ingredients are going to go well with the base ingredient that you selected, what ingredients are used in the cuisines that you selected, and what types of ingredients are needed to make the dish that you chose. So once we have that, we're going to try all the possible combinations of ingredients, and we're going to narrow them down, and then we're going to evaluate them using three methods. The first method we call surprise, and it basically evaluates the novelty of the recipe, how different it is from existing recipes. The second one, called pleasantness, is a prediction of how the dish will taste, whether it will taste good or not. And the third prediction is called pairing, chemical pairing, if you want. It's based on the flavor pairing hypothesis. That's an hypothesis that says that the more flavor compounds the ingredients share, the more likely they are to taste good together.
So you also collaborated with real-life chefs for this project. What did that collaboration look like?
Yes, so we partnered with the Institute of Culinary Education in New York. I mean, we started by just, you know, talking with them about how they create new recipes, what process do they follow. And that inspired us to create our prototype. And then as soon as we had something ready that we could share with them, we went to their kitchens, and they played with the tool to create new recipes. They entered combinations of ingredients, and they cooked the dishes to see if it was, I guess in the beginning, to see if it was edible, and then to see how good it was.
Was there any dishes that weren't edible?
No, I don't think there were any dishes that weren't edible. I mean, there were just dishes that were very original, and some of them that were more boring.
Can you give an example of a really original recipe?
I guess we could take the chocolate burrito as an example. It's a burrito that contains beef, chocolate, edamame, and apricot puree.
And that was good?
Oh, yeah, that was really good. And we served that at South by Southwest. Everybody seemed to like it.
Wow. So in my hand, I'm holding some barbecue sauce, Bengali butternut barbecue sauce, and this is made by Watson. Can you describe how this barbecue sauce came about?
So again, that's something we did for South by Southwest. We wanted to have something we could give away during the festival, and we came up with the idea of doing a barbecue sauce. So that's the first input we entered in the system. And then the system came back and gave us a list of ingredients that people use in barbecue sauces. And one of them was butternut squash, I think. And so we picked butternut squash. That sounded interesting. And then the system told us what cuisines use butternut squash the most. And in the list, we found Bengali. So that's how we decided that a Bengali butternut squash barbecue sauce was pretty interesting. And then the system did the rest. It came up with 5,000 possibilities for a Bengali butternut squash barbecue sauce. And we started refining the ingredients by looking at the scores, surprise, pleasantness, pairing, and also, you know, including some ingredients we liked best, excluding some ingredients we didn't like.
Okay, Florian, final question. What is your favorite thing that Watson has made?
First, I have to say that what I like best about this is that you can create a new dish all the time. Every time for the rest of your life, you can eat something new. I mean, maybe that's even more interesting than any specific dish, is the excitement of trying something new all the time. But if you want me to choose one, there's the bacon and porcini mushroom pudding that we made, again, for South by Southwest. That was particularly delicious because It's a dessert, but it's got savory elements, things you wouldn't typically put in a dessert, mushrooms and bacon, and it just worked.
Do you ever find yourself having some reservations when you see what Watson pops out before you taste it?
Well, yes. I'd say sometimes, you know, we see the ingredients that come out, and we're kind of amused. yeah, when you think of the beef chocolate, the edamame, and apricot puree, like, yeah, okay, it's kind of funny. Another example recently, I mean, I was doing an Italian chocolate cake for somebody who picked those particular parameters. And I thought that was kind of, you know, I mean, not boring, but that was a pretty classic choice. And I tried to make it interesting. So I started saying, okay, let's go for the olive oil, the corn flour, the potato. And then I realized that I was the one who was going to cook that cake, and that wasn't trivial. These are not the things you use usually when you make a cake. That was kind of a challenge, but that was very interesting.
Well, Florian Pinnell, thanks for speaking with me.
You're welcome.
Producer Zach Nugent there, speaking with Florian Pinnell, who's senior software engineer for cognitive cooking, IBM Watson Group. If you'd like to try one of Watson's recipes, we do have a link to some of those South by Southwest dishes. You'll find it at wordofmouthradio.org. Today marks the first day of the Feast of San Fermín in Pamplona, Spain, also known as the Running of the Bulls. While throngs of revelers are trying to avoid getting gored across the pond, we're going to engorge ourselves with a tale of food and Spanish history transformed into an American tradition. The Kitchen Sisters, producers Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva, take us into the remote and rugged world of Basque sheep herders in the American West and introduce us to their outdoor, below-the-ground cooking traditions.
I'm John Esquaga, John Esquaga's Nugget Casino in Sparks, Nevada. We've been there 48 years. I'm a Basque, if you know what the Basque people are, from the Pyrenees. My dad was a sheep herder when he first came over, about 1900. There's a great number of Basque sheep herders in Idaho, Nevada, California, Montana, New Mexico. In fact, on the ranch where I live, I still have 75 sheep. I just want to keep my heritage going. We have a Basque restaurant at the Nugget, Orozco. That's my dad's hometown in the Basque country.
What about baking, that great Basque bread?
Sure, Dutch oven. Dutch oven. If you didn't know how to make bread being a sheep herder, I don't think you'd survive. Our government had a program bringing a lot of the sheep herders over from the Basque country. They were in dire need of sheep herders because nobody wanted to herd sheep in America. That's a lonely job.
My name is Francisco Lasarte.
My name is Joaquin Lasarte.
Basque
sheep herder.
You lonely. You by yourself, 2,000 sheep and 2 dogs. 3 years, you stay there. No vacation, no day off, no holidays. You stay 24 hours close to the sheep.
We make $7 a day. They pay you only once a year.
You cook outside, mostly under the ground. You make fire. You have a Dutch oven. You can cook bread. 90% times it's lamb.
You say Basque to a Westerner and they think shepherd. In Basque country, very few people are shepherds. I'm Mark Kurlansky. I wrote a book called The Basque History of the World. Basques would go out in Western America and for the first time in their life have this huge flock of sheep over a huge expanse of land. Nobody has huge expanses of land in European Basque country.
In 1964,
came to the United States. I have a horrible life in Spain in that time because Franco... You cannot go anywhere. You cannot say anything. Only way you can came to United States, working sheep herders. Hundreds of people like that in that time in the Franco power.
They would have a sponsor that would get them over here. They were told, go to Noriega Hotel in Bakersfield. My name is Linda Elizalde McCoy. The guys would come in off the train from Ellis Island, make their way to the West Coast. My grandmother would see to it that they were fed, and then their boss would pick them up.
I'm Bernadette Irigoyen, Noriega Hotel. I've been working here for 42 years. I have 3 brothers. They were shepherds, and then I came to cook. Just guys, no women. I make stew and flan, blue sausage, paella, family style. A lot of Bascos.
Basque sheep herders who were seasonally laid off would spend months in a Basque hotel. The hotels took the old world Basque cuisine, things that were festive food in the Basque country, and they made it standard fare. Beef, chicken dishes, coffee. By the time the herders got down to town, he had all the lamb he'd wanted to eat for a while. William Douglas, the Center for Basque Studies, University of Nevada, Reno.
You count your sheep and you give the water. The worst part, I think, it's in the alfalfa, because if you not take care of it in the alfalfa, a lot of sheep blow.
What do you mean they blow?
They blow. They eat. They never stop it on the gas. They blow it out. You can do huge damages.
It was very hard. 18-year-old kid who's been ripped up out of his community in Europe, and all of a sudden he's in a foreign land with a foreign language, and he's up on top of a mountain with a bunch of sheep. Amongst Basque, there's a whole vocabulary of madness. The sheep herder who goes over the edge, who becomes sagebrushed or sheeped.
It's called the Irinsi. It's a kind of a war whoop. You know, these people didn't have cell phones, and they would call from one area to another to get someone's attention.
You
are listening to the Basque Hour, KBOI in Boise, Idaho, every Sunday at this hour.
My name is Rosita Alegria Artis. My mother was Espy Alegria. She had a Basque radio program that went out to the sheep herders, the voice of the Basque. They listened in their sheep camps. They had little transistors. She wished them happy birthdays, gave them the soccer scores in Basque. During the Franco years, he did suppress the language. The only place you could use it was at home in secret. She'd translate for them. If they had a problem with immigration, she did for them. They never paid her, but occasionally they would give her a lamb. We would throw it on the kitchen table and cut it up and freeze it.
The sheep herder, they organize barbecue and dance and everything. Big day for us.
I have a lot of pictures of Mom dancing at the Basque sheep herder's ball. The men wore Levi's and the women wore house dresses. An accordion, a tambourine, and somebody would play the spoons. They auctioned off a lamb. They had chorizos, Basque sausage. They have a sandwich, pork tenderloin and pimentos, hard crust bread.
I still have some memories, some good ones and some bad ones. Maybe I can sing with those two guys sheep herder song.
Hidden Kitchens is produced by the Kitchen Sisters and mixed by Jim McKee. We'll get a taste of the invasive war movement when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. From kudzu to the Asian longhorned beetle, invasive plants and animals are transforming ecosystems around the globe. Notoriously hard to eradicate. Common but often ineffective strategies for coping with them include using pesticides, habitat manipulation, and introduction of new predators, a tricky tactic which risks bringing even more aggressive invaders into the mix. One unusual conservation method that's been gaining traction over the past few years aims to wipe out invasives one dinner plate at a time. Freelance science writer Hannah Newman wrote about the so-called invasivore movement for Quartz.
What's really interesting about this movement, it's that it's a decentralized movement. You have citizen scientists, chefs, people, you know, foragers in their own backyards. And I spoke to a lot of scientists that have spearheaded this movement, and it really came from them doing their own studies, and they often eat their study organisms. So I talked to this guy, Matthew Dines, who co-founded invasivore.org, and he mentioned that it really hit him when he was out studying rusty crayfish, and they often, you know, eat these when they're studying them. And while he was eating them, he said, "Hey, you know what? These are pretty good. We should start teaching people about this and spreading the word that this could be a way to help combat the invasive species problem."
Well, I guess, though, I think of the kind of bad name that many of these invasive species have earned, like kudzu. I mean, we've come to think of it as something that is spreading all over the South, especially not as something we can eat. How do we make that kind of mental adjustment between cursing out a plant and then eating it?
Yeah, I think that is one of the biggest challenges to this movement, is getting people on board with the idea of almost kind of rebranding what these species are. And I think a huge factor that has helped is restaurant chefs getting on board with this idea and kind of helping to convince us that they don't have to be crazy. They can be delicious.
So you tried some of these species, including something called burdock that you tried at the New York City restaurant Suen. And by the way, there are a couple of restaurants in New York City that are actually serving invasive species. How was the burdock?
Yeah, I gotta say, I did not like the burdock. And apparently it can be quite delicious. So I don't know if I had a bad batch or just the way it was prepared. But I got to say that that burdock was not among my favorite invasive that I've tasted thus far.
Okay, but how about the lionfish, which sounded interesting? Did you try Asian carp? Tell us about the others you tried.
Yeah, so I had lionfish at, I had actually Chef Bun Lai's sashimi, and I also had lionfish tacos at Norman's K, which is a restaurant here in Manhattan. And man, I gotta say, I tried it, and at first, I think I was almost a little disappointed because, you know, I was expecting fireworks or disgust or something crazy to happen when I first bit into these tacos, and they were just delicious. They were so good. They tasted like any, I mean, I love fish, and they tasted like any other white fish, nice and light and flaky, and I would have them again in a heartbeat. And the sashimi was great. Chef Bun Lai has really been amazing and spearheading kind of, you know, this rebranding almost that I talk about and not making these invasives so scary and making me want to try them. So I tried jellyfish in his sushi. I tried invasive blue catfish. There was a salad of all these different invasive weeds like Japanese knotweed and garlic mustard. And he makes this dressing out of dead man's finger seaweed, which is also an invasive species with a little, you know, olive oil, vinegar, salt, pepper. Probably one of the best salads I've ever eaten in my life.
I'm talking with Hannah Newman. She's a freelance science writer discussing her recent article about invasivorism that she wrote for Quartz, which is a digital news service. Invasivorism is the trend of purposefully eating invasive species to reduce their impact. So, Hannah, it sounds like you had a pretty good experience trying chef-prepared dishes of some invasive species. But can you imagine this for yourself? You know, I don't know, trapping an armadillo and cooking it up for dinner.
Well, I can't say that I will be near any armadillo anytime soon. But I could definitely see myself going out and just foraging for some greens that are so abundant and, you know, really detrimental to some of these native populations. They're driving biodiversity loss and they need to be eliminated. And if they're edible and nutritious and have lots of vitamins and good things for me, I don't see why not.
So I guess, Hannah, we've established that just because you're doing good doesn't mean it's necessarily good eating, although you've pointed out that there are some really good foods that you've tried. On the flip side, several people you quote talk about how invasivorism is actually working too well and could make the problem worse. Now, help us understand that case.
Yeah, I think the biggest criticism going on with this movement right now is the idea that if it takes off, that's actually a problem. So the goal here is to reduce the number of these things, not to spread them. Mm-hmm. So the worry is that, you know, if everyone really loves lionfish, we're going to start shipping them all around. We're going to spread them and make them more invasive as opposed to less invasive.
So, Hannah, that fear aside, do you think the invasive war movement could really make a big difference? I mean, what's the possibility that we can eradicate an invasive species by eating it?
One of my real questions when I came into trying to understand this whole thing is that really the goal here? And can that even be possible? So something that I had searched for in my quest to understand and eat some of these invasives is scientific evidence to even suggest that this could work or it is working. And I think in terms of answering that question, one, we've seen it work a little bit already in Jamaica. There's been some evidence that suggests that eating lionfish populations have actually decreased the number of lionfish by something like 66%. But besides that, the movement is really too new to tell whether or not it's going to work. And I think it also is going to vary depending species by species. I think lionfish and Asian carp are really good examples where it could work, whereas some other species, such as, you know, dandelions, we're not going to be able to eat all the dandelion weeds, you know, unless dandelion becomes the next kale. Which I don't know if that's going to happen anytime soon. I don't necessarily think that we're going to have the best success rate with dandelions.
Hannah Newman, freelance science writer. We do have a link to read her article about invasivorism on Quartz or QZ.com. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Hannah, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. There's much more to explore and to pass around and share with friends on our website at wordofmouthradio.org, including what you'll find there today, some recipes for invasive species. These are some of the things invasivores have come up with that may or may not tempt your palate. And we'd like to know if you've made any dishes using invasive species. Keep in mind, that means smelt and northern pike here in New Hampshire. Also rainbow trout. Okay, we'll accept all comers at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us. You can send us your feedback and share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. That's how we hear a lot of interesting things. I'm guessing you do too. By word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll keep bringing them back to you tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.